Good afternoon. Welcome to the Democracy Forum. This is the third program in our series this year to broadcast at this time on the third Friday of each month. We're featuring topics in Maine's participatory democracy, encouraging citizens to take an active role in government and politics. This program is a project of the League of Women Voters Down East, produced in cooperation with WERU-FM. Our conversation today is Unions and Democracy, Take Two. We'll revisit topics from our show in 2021, talking about the historical and contemporary links between labor organizing and expanding political rights like voting. Is union organizing an important, if not essential, tool in building a vibrant democracy of people having a voice in their government? What led to the demise of unions over the last half century, and what have been the political consequences? Are unions now making a comeback, and why is that? What new trends are emerging right here in Maine? This show was pre-recorded on March 13th. Send your comments to news@weru.org. Please put Democracy Forum in the subject line. This is Ann Luther from the League of Women Voters of Maine. I'll be your host for the Democracy Forum. Let me introduce our guests, David Madland. David is a senior fellow and senior advisor to the American Worker Project at the Center for American Progress. So happy to have you back, David.
Thanks very much for having me.
Arthur Phillips is economic policy analyst at the Maine Center for Economic Policy. Welcome, Arthur.
Thank you, Ann.
And Cynthia Finney. Cynthia is president of the Maine AFL-CIO. Welcome back, Cynthia.
Thanks. Good to be back, Ann.
So let's get started. David, I think I'll put the first sort of big picture question to you. It seems like there's a surge in union organizing. Does that really, is that happening, or is that just the way it seems?
Yeah, there's a lot happening with unions and a growing interest in workers joining unions and much more grassroots worker organizing we've seen in recent years. The stats sort of bear this out. For example, on strikes, we have about twice the amount of strikes last year as in the previous years. More workers trying to form unions through petitions and growing public interest in unions. So certainly, I think this is a moment where the public eye is on unions right now.
Why do you think that's happening now?
I think there's a lot that's behind that. I would put it down to some long-term trends and then some recent phenomenons. The long-term trends have been sort of stagnant wages for many decades for most workers who's struggling to get ahead. And then you add on these recent things, for example, the COVID pandemic where workers were deemed essential, but often sort of thrown to the wolves and put in high risk jobs while their companies had record profits. And then as the economy starts to recover and really is doing pretty well with really low unemployment, the workers remember those incredible frustrations they had, but have a little bit more power now to exert their frustrations. And so I think you're seeing this really coming to a head right now.
Does a tight labor market play into that?
Yes, the tight labor market helps. That's what I mentioned, the low unemployment, because that means that workers have more options. They are just, they feel like if they, get disciplined at their current job, they might be able to find another job more easily than at other points. So I think that emboldened them a little bit.
How does that feel from your perspective, Cynthia? You're the head of a union. Does that resonate what David said?
Absolutely. And actually, our organization is a federation of unions. So we have over 200 labor organizations that are affiliated. So we're able to see this kind of firsthand across a number of industries and all the way from the top to the bottom of the state and east to west. And definitely a big surge in the number of folks who are reaching out to us, asking us to connect them with a union, asking us what's involved with forming a union. Especially younger people, but not only younger people.
Arthur, you wrote a paper last Labor Day that talked about how labor organizing is landing in Maine. Could you sort of summarize what you found when you looked at that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we're seeing some of the same trends we're seeing nationally, which Cynthia and David already pointed to. But I think there's been an uptick in organizing, and it spans a lot of different sectors. We see it in higher education. We see it in hospitality. We see it in big corporate employers. We see it in small, independently owned shops, public, private sector. So yeah, we've seen a lot of activity. We've seen some really big wins in Maine. Of course, the nurses at Maine Med recently, that's about a nearly 2,000 worker shop, about 1,000 grad student workers. And then we've seen it down to, you know, small shops that have gone for voluntary recognition, which is outside of the federal election process, where there might be 8 to 10 workers at a small coffee shop, for example. So yeah, we've seen a lot of activity in Maine. And of course, we've seen some enormous activity at the national level that David alluded to.
I mean, I'm interested in some of these new sectors, like adjunct professors unionizing. That is not where you would have maybe thought, you know, 2 decades ago. What's with that?
Well, I would just say that, you know, I think workers throughout our economy are experiencing a lot of precariousness in terms of the, you know, whether they can count on having a job that can support themselves and their families on. And, you know, the academic labor market is certainly one of those places. It's happening all over the place, but certainly adjunct professors have seen a real decline in terms of the standard of working conditions and pay that they expected probably when they embarked on the process of getting a PhD and pursuing that kind of work. Luckily, we've seen a really pretty significant explosion of activity in academic worker organizing. I think the UAW, the United Auto Workers, people might be surprised to know, have about 100,000 academic members nationwide, as I said, including those thousands, roughly 1,000 new members up in Orono. And of course, adjunct workers at our public institutions of higher ed here in Maine also have some union representation. But that's a critical piece. And I think a really important thing that we're seeing in other states and possibly here in Maine as well is connections being drawn between different academic workers so that tenured professors are working in concert with adjunct workers who are working with grad student workers and supporting one another, you know, all the way down to dining service workers, you know, seeing those bargaining units come together and show each other solidarity, we've seen more of that in recognition that the academic jobs are certainly more tenuous than they were a generation ago.
Is what Arthur says a trend nationwide? David, are other states experiencing similar to what we are here in Maine?
Yes. I mean, if you're asking specifically about the adjunct professor, you know, that's certainly a big trend that unfortunately the quality of those jobs over past decades has, you know, significantly deteriorated and universities are ever more reliant on them. So there are more workers in that sort of category and they are then seeking ways to improve their working conditions. And like lots of other workers, they're finding that forming a union gives them a little bit more power to bargain collectively and improve their conditions. And you also, as Arthur noted, seeing a range of different unions organizing those workers forming with a host of different. The other sort of new organizing that I think we mentioned a little bit earlier that I think is worth touching on is this young people phenomenon that, you know, the young people, this generation is the most pro-union generation of any generation. You know, all workers are quite pro-union right now, but especially young people. And I see that really translating into some of the jobs that are most likely to be done by young people. You see the Starbucks workers, for example, trying to organize. And that's like retail and those kind of jobs are typically not unionized. And we're seeing a moment where that might change right now.
Where did that come from among young people? I mean, unions not taught in high school, is it? Like, how did people come around to that? You know, young people.
I'll take a guess. I don't think we know for certain, but my hunch is that sort of the economy has been especially precarious for young people, that they have kind of only known a world. So they grew up, they were coming of age, just, you know, like the Great Recession, 2007, 2009, worldwide financial crisis was kind of when they were really young. And then just as they're kind of entering the labor market, they have the global pandemic and a huge recession. And I think the inherent instability of this, their working lives has been very apparent to them. And I also think there is just a larger recognition that, you know, if workers don't come together, the kind of common view of how the economy worked, that they were kind of brought down, this sort of trickle down economics might not be the best for them, that they can actually work together to change that and make it so that they could have a good job.
Is that reflected in your membership, Cynthia, more young people?
Certainly, if one took the number of organizing drives, that would be That would be true, but in terms of number of members, perhaps not, because the larger, well, there was 1,000 with the UMaine grad workers. Those are, of course, all younger workers, but there were 2,000 nurses at Maine Med. And that, of course, spans a huge age range. But yes, lots of interest from all workers, but young workers in particular. And some of those cannabis workers actually are organizing in Maine and across the country. And also a lot of workers in nonprofits, which isn't a sector that had unionized very heavily in the past. And that's happening across the country. And some of why it's happening in Maine is because workers here see workers like them in other places doing it. And I think probably workers in other places also see Maine doing it, and it carries through.
How many of Maine's hospitals have nursing unions? Is it just Maine Med, or what about the other ones?
No, I don't know the number, but Eastern Maine Medical Center, Callis, Northern Lights, the nurses in Fort Kent just voted to unionize a couple weeks ago. There's quite a number of hospitals. Until the Maine Med vote, most of them were Bangor and East.
Mm-hmm. I saw you nodding there, Arthur. Do you want to add something to this topic about nursing unions? And
I was just going to say that, yes, it's the Maine Med victory of a couple of years ago was really tremendous. Obviously, it's the biggest hospital in the state, and it's the biggest employer in the state, I believe. And Eastern Maine Medical Center is also a very significant union. So there's a really significant block of nurses who've chosen to organize and work collectively to improve their working conditions. And there is this session, and Cynthia can certainly speak to this, is there's an important bill which really speaks to the nurse staffing ratios, which is really an issue that impacts nurses and patients alike, which I think is a trend that we're seeing a lot more of as well, is workers finding common cause with the people that they serve through their work. And so I think nurses are understanding that their jobs in many instances are unsustainable because they don't have the requisite staffing to do their jobs the way that they would like to. And that has impacts both on their own health and on the health of their patients. So there is a really important bill being heard at Maine State Legislature in Augusta to mandate that there's some limits and some requirements in terms of how many nurses can be assigned to how many patients at a given time. And just to very quickly go back to the young workers piece, it is interesting that, there's kind of this, not a lost generation, but we've seen a really significant decline in union membership in the last several decades. And so the young people who we're seeing having this, really high rates of approval for unions and interest in joining one and doing the organizing to form them, they really come out of, for the most part, households that didn't have any union members.
Right.
Or more often than not didn't have any union members. So it's really interesting to see them kind of, really trying to make sense of the world and figure out how are they going to make a life for themselves and build a family if they so choose. And they're reaching kind of into the past and not from their own experience in some ways. And I would also just say that it would be great if we did teach unions more in high school. I think that, California recently passed a bill that basically required there to be some level of public education at the high school level about what rights workers have and what unions are and what rights workers have that are protected in terms of concerted activity and coming together to form unions or solve problems at the workplace. And I think that that's a really tremendous idea, one that I'd love to see replicated elsewhere.
And I mean, speaking of adjunct faculty and nursing has this whole trend that we see playing out here of itinerant nurses. Like, these are not full-time people. They come in for a gig and then they go on to another gig. I mean, does unionizing help? I mean, well, I don't know if help's the right word, but like, what's the relationship between this itinerant workforce and unionizing? Cynthia, or?
I think part of the issue, it's one of the many factors that drive some of the workers to want to have a union, because they see the management at the hospital solving in quotes problems by just bringing in people who they pay a lot more than the people who are committed long term to the institution, and not really solving the problem by having folks who are on a itinerant job as opposed to being regular full time employees with benefits and a career investment in the institution. And I was also going to say that another thing that, and Arthur started touching on this, but another thing that drives workers and that I think is driving the current wave is not just what's happening to them on the job, but the ability to do their job well for the people they're trying to serve. And a union, when they join together in union, they have more protection to be able to speak up about things that they see happening, and also more ability to work together to influence how things are done to serve those people when they see policies that they, you know, that are problematic for them in terms of delivering the best service.
Would you say that's true among teachers' unions as well?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. You're tuned to the Democracy Forum on WERU-FM. This is Ann Luther, the League of Women Voters of Maine. Our topic today is Unions and Democracy, Take Two. Our guests are Arthur Phillips, Economic Policy Analyst at the Maine Center for Economic Policy, Cynthia Finney, President of the Maine AFL-CIO, and David Madland, Senior Fellow and Senior Advisor to the American Worker Project at the Center for American Progress. This program was pre-recorded on March 13th. No listener calls are being taken. So this resurgence in unionizing and interest in union organizing, I want to ask, like, Dave, and this is for you, David, is this good for democracy, and why or why not?
I think it's very good for democracy. And that's, you know, I'm going to be a little academic here, but hopefully it's going to be okay. Sort of, to me, there are three big things that unions do to help make democracy function. The first is they increase participation, especially amongst those who are least likely to participate, those with less education, for example. So more people are more are going to turn out to vote. The second thing that unions do is they help sort of behind the scenes. They're the lobbyists for worker issues. And unfortunately, most organized interests that are actually lobbying and do behind the scenes work in state houses and in the federal government work against what the public wants. They're supporting like a specific tax break for whoever. And unions, and the academics research shows this, are about the only public, one of the few public interest groups that are actually out there lobbying for things that most people want, like, for example, a higher minimum wage. And then the last thing that unions do is that they help equalize economic resources. They basically raise wages for the bottom and middle class and reduce CEO compensation so that we have a more equalized society, which in a democracy, you know, economic resources definitely influence, but when you minimize those differences, you are making the democracy more equitable. So all three of those factors, the boosting participation, increasing representation, and then equalizing economics are critical in making our kind of political democracy work well. And the more workers we have in unions, the better our democracy works.
I wanted to add to that that unions are themselves democratic organizations. Union members, if they attend union meetings, learn how Robert's rules work, which is, you know, how things run in the legislative bodies. And they also vote, and they have both representative and direct democracy models at different levels within different unions. And consistent with what David talked about, just this last Thursday, we had 150 workers we took to the state house. We teach them how a bill becomes law. We teach them how to find their legislator and talk to them. And for many of them, it's the first time they've ever participated that directly in lawmaking. And they get really excited. It's wonderful.
Yeah, Cynthia is talking about this. Sorry to jump in, but the schools of democracy, like there are many schools, unions are many schools of democracy that I think are very effective, and especially for those who are least likely to participate. That's really, you know, the key thing here is people with higher educations and higher incomes are sort of more naturally exposed. They have more experience with these kinds of things. And how do you get everyone else to understand and learn and participate? And the schools of democracy is really a key way.
I wanted to ask you about whether, you know, the U.S. has been sort of slipping on these measures of democracy for a little while. And I wanted to ask you if there was a correlation between the way we are not as robust a democracy as we were 30, 40 years ago. Is there a causal relation or any kind of relation between those slipping measures of democracy and slipping union membership, do you think?
Yeah, I think there's a relationship between sort of the decline in union membership in the U.S. and the quality of our democracy. It's maybe not exactly clear and exactly causal, but I think the sort of the key thing. So we have tremendous frustrations amongst the American public right now that democracy is not seen as responsive to their interests and needs, nor is the economy. And as we mentioned, unions address that. And so the greater frustration, I think, is a key part of the great frustration that the American public has is in part caused by the decline of unions. Unions also, I think, play this important filter role. It's this mediated civil society that it's you're having an actually an internal discussion about issues rather than just being provoked by the most extreme thing that's happening. That is, you know, clearly part of what's problematic in American democracy right now is the most extreme elements are getting heard and voiced, and rather than having these internal discussions, you know, just also the more broadly relationship, you know, this isn't exactly about the U.S., but the relationship internationally is pretty clear as well, that unions are typically the voice and force for bringing more people into a democracy to make it actually a real thing rather than kind of an elite plutocracy system where just the elites have a voice. So this sort of tradition and history and the necessity of some level, what unions do, what they, in order for the unions to succeed, they need a democratic system. The whole thing they're pushing for is that ordinary people have a greater input, and that necessitates pushing for democracy.
I think we talked 3 years ago about Czechoslovakia and how the pro-democracy movement and the Czech Republic came out of a labor movement. Does that happen a lot?
Yes. Well, sadly, kind of most of the European origins of labor unions were fighting for democracy. You know, they had these either king systems, or they had a very partial democracy that was only for elites. And the workers were demanding broader participation, and their broader participation was both in the economy and in the political sphere. And so that's very much the origins of unions. But you see it not just in ancient history, but most everywhere where there's a fight for greater democracy. South Korea, for example, unions have been key in pushing there. So there's sort of almost inherently intertwined when there's a push for democracy that there's going to be a labor movement as a key player.
And Cynthia, since we've got you here, and it's a little poetry that you're the first woman president of the AFL-CIO, I want to ask you about the linkage between women's suffrage and feminism and women's equality in the workforce and union women in unions.
I'll just correct that. I'm the first elected woman. Gwen Gatcombe served out Charlie O'Leary's term, but didn't run for a term. So I'm the first elected. But yes, I think so. I mean, the statistics consistently over and over and over show that having a union raises wages and income and benefits for women, and that having more unions raises, you know, the standard of living across states where unions have density. And the more resources people have, the more free they are to participate in democracy. We don't get paid for participating in our democracy. And if we can't hold our family together and get the groceries home, we don't have time to participate in democracy. So to the extent that people have economic security, it's easier to participate in the civic democracy. And so I think we play a key role in that way in terms of helping women. And also people gain through their collective action a sense of power. And it took a sense of entitlement to power for women to fight for the vote. And as it takes a sense to entitlement to power to fight for any improvement in our society.
We have this question in here that's a little provocative, but it's about partisanship and unions. Like, is union membership good for democracy, or is it just good for Democrats? And, you know, the Teamsters made headlines last couple of weeks when they, for the first time, gave significantly to the Republican National Committee. What about the partisanship angle? And I don't know, I see you smiling, Cynthia, so maybe you'd like to take first crack at that.
Sure. Our members cut across the political spectrum, and we have members everywhere on the political spectrum for whom, regardless of their political views, deeply cherish and value their union. And when workers come together to fight for something in the workplace, those political divisions fall aside. And it's one of the reasons that I feel like unions are a key piece of the hope for bridging the divides that we have in the larger society, because unions are a place where people are working together on common cause without regard to political affiliation or divisions there.
What do you think it meant that the Teamsters gave to the Republicans for the first time? Why do you think they did that?
I'm not going to try to read their minds.
David, do you have any idea?
Many, if not most, unions tend to contribute to both parties. They ideally want to be able to work with both parties. And so I think my sense is it's a piece of that. They also give money to Democrats as well. And I think it's just part of here's how we can continue to have a working relationship, even if we may disagree on some issues, but we want to find common ground. And, you know, politically, I might have a different view, but I think that ultimately is a good thing for both, you know, to have a little bit of a foot in both camps and trying to work with both sides.
You know, one of our board members works with nursing unions, and she was sort of coaching us as we prepare for this program. And she said the nursing unions make deep investments in racial justice, anti-poverty, and environmental justice, pro-democracy measures. I mean, this is like over and above their workplace issues. And she said they do that because they see these things as determinants of health for the population that they serve. And I wanted to ask maybe Arthur, any of you that know, is this a common practice among unions who, and I think again of teachers, who the union makes investments to serve their clients in that way?
Yeah, I can start. I mean, I do think that unions like those that represent and organize with nurses and teachers who really serve the public good in that way may be more inclined to make those investments. I think that there's a political culture in the nurses union that has that expansive view of their role as a political organization and how they can kind of more broadly contribute to public health and chipping away at racist structures in the economy. You know, it is very clear that unions have an important role to play in combating racial inequality. They also make all workers healthier. They raise the bar in terms of, you know, what kind of health benefits workers can expect from their employers. You know, I think something like 84% of union workers participate in employer-sponsored healthcare plans compared to just 54% of non-union workers. So there's clearly a great advantage to being in union in terms of the benefits that you can that you can count on for your family. But I think also lots of unions recognize that the difference between what workers in unionized and non-unionized shops, you know, the widening gap between the value of those things really makes it even harder to win more workers into the union in some cases, because the employers are looking to fight that much more because they understand that there's a real cost compared to kind of the low road that they can take without a union being involved.
Speaking of the low road, Maine has been fighting to organize agricultural workers, and that has not been successful so far, has it, Arthur?
It hasn't been successful so far. So there have been, you know, several iterations of different bills to expand the rights of farm workers who your listeners may know were excluded from some of the fundamental protections that workers won at the federal level in the 1930s and through New Deal legislation like the Fair Labor Standards Act, which set minimum wage and other wage and hour laws, and the National Labor Relations Act, which covers private sector union and worker rights across the country. Farm workers were excluded from both of those. They are now covered through parts of the Fair Labor Standards Act, so that they are covered by the federal minimum wage of $7.25, which is a far cry from Maine's statewide minimum wage of $14.15. So there have been bills in recent years to make sure that farm workers enjoy the same rights as other private sector workers, including the right to come together and collectively bargain, as well as just, you know, plain and simple coverage under the statewide minimum wage. There was a bill last session that was advanced through both houses of the legislature, and at the 11th hour was vetoed by the governor. Governor Mills did convene a stakeholder group to deliberate further on some of the issues impacting farm workers and farmers and what the implications of that bill would be. And we do actually anticipate her to introduce a bill in the coming days and for there to be deliberations on that. And, you know, this is a long time coming. It's 90 years that farm workers have been treated like second class citizens in Maine and many other states. But a lot of states have made progress in extending those collective bargaining rights and protection under minimum wage and overtime hours. And I think it's really high time that Maine joins that wave.
You're tuned to the Democracy Forum on WERU-FM. This is Ann Luther from the League of Women Voters of Maine. Our guests this afternoon are Cynthia Finney, President of the Maine AFL-CIO, David Madlin, Senior Fellow and Senior Advisor to the American Worker Project at the Center for American Progress, and Arthur Phillips, Economic Policy Analyst at the Maine Center for Economic Policy. Our topic today is Unions and Democracy, Take Two. This show was pre-recorded. Send your comments or questions to news@weru.org. Please put Democracy Forum in the subject line. I'd like to turn now maybe to some of the counter arguments, like who thinks unions are bad and why? And is it pure greed, or are there, you know, principles at stake? Just because it's coming up again, I wanted to start with this little bit of history about the constitutionality of the National Labor Relations Board, which was challenged in 1937, right? Tell about that, David, and then bring us up to date with the challenge that's happening now.
The time when the National Labor Relations Act was passed, was part of this broad New Deal conception of raising standards for workers through significant federal legislation, including the federal minimum wage and the like. And courts, the Supreme Court had been striking down many, many of these kinds of policies, deeming them unconstitutional, largely that they felt that the unconstitutional interference with interstate commerce. And when the National Labor Relations Act was passed, some employers said, we're just going to ignore it. We're going to still fire our workers for trying to form a union, because we think that the courts will strike this down as they've been striking down many other laws. And so in 1937, the Supreme Court decided to support the National Labor Relations Act. And this was very big news. This was seen as like the switch in time that saves nine, that to prevent the plans to pack the Supreme Court, which were, you know, Franklin Roosevelt was considering, because the court was so hostile to his agenda. And instead, the court reconsidered and said, actually, yeah, you know what? We can have this kind of economic policy legislation to ensure workers' standards can be raised. And so from that point on, largely courts have, you know, acceded to this idea that the federal as well as state governments can regulate economic policy. We are unfortunately, and I think this is what you were going to hit at in some of your questions, was we are at a point where the courts are coming to question that again. And we have several big companies that are now again challenging the constitutionality of the National Labor Relations Act. And the court has not yet taken up the case, but it's very possible that they might.
And what is what are the grounds for these challenges in a constitutional way? Like, I mean, I know it's about the money and I know it's about profits, but like from a principled standpoint, what are they arguing?
I'm deeply skeptical of these kinds of claims. And I feel not that there aren't some rationale for being concerned about unions or opposing that, but these kind of court cases, I feel, are just political. Like this Supreme Court right now is so political that anyone who shares their politics feels like they have a shot if they go there. The questions they raise to me are about, you know, like it's the appropriate nature of, can you have a administration law judge making decisions about findings? There's like, we lose the train of thought when we go in, when we give there too much credence to the actual arguments. You know, I normally try to be the academic and have a more, you know, distance view, but I find so much of this just so political and deeply troubling because it's, in my mind, relatively little substance behind it.
Yeah, but there is a strain of American political thought about private property, and that the levers of democracy are here to protect the minority from the rampaging majority who are coming to get their money. And I mean, is that part of it?
Possibly, but I don't think that's really behind these lawsuits. But yes, there's a strain of thought that dislikes unions as sort of a collective voice that challenges a lone individual's autonomy. I think there's some interesting thoughts to that. To me, the sort of contrasts are, and in fact, a fair amount of libertarians end up liking labor unions because they see them as a better solution than government action. Because, how do you set standards for workers? Well, should workers and employers negotiate or should the government set them? And there's very much of a libertarian strain that says, well, it's much better for this collective bargaining process to be doing so. And on this sort of individual strains, you know, I also find that funny. I often get in debates with, you know, people who will say, well, a union contract could force a worker to pay the costs of the collective bargaining coverage, and that's somehow in interfering with the worker's rights. And I would say, okay, possibly, but they generally gain greater rights. They had a majoritarian process, an election to decide whether they wanted to do this. But I don't see you concerned that an employer could force a worker to cut their hair, or an employer could force a worker to wear this particular uniform, or attend a forced political meeting where, you know, okay, a political candidate's going to be here. And so I think many of the concerns about individual rights are very selective. And generally, unions give workers much greater individual rights. Yes, it takes a collective process, but then as an individual, you aren't going to be fired arbitrarily, aren't going to be forced into these kinds of, arbitrary decisions that employers can make.
So what do strategies look like when companies push back? I know the Chipotle workers got a ruling. Was that the National Labor Relations Board that reinstated? Go ahead, Cynthia, tell what happened there.
Yeah, part of the act gives the right to file unfair labor practice charges, which they did with their union, because the National Labor Relations Act prevents employers from closing just because there was a union there.
So is that what happened in the Chipotle case? They closed a store?
Yeah. Once the workers voted, I think they did it on the day of the vote, perhaps. I forget the exact details, but yes. And so, of course, the workers had to make their case and prove it, but the board was convinced. And I wanted to add to what David was saying, and in many ways, it's the same thing David was saying, but just in a slightly different way, that there's been a movement on the part of corporations and many of the wealthy class to free themselves from regulation. And the National Labor Relations Act was a compromise. Workers gave up some rights as well. And if the act were to be overturned, then we would return to the days where, without the ability to have the assistance of the act in creating order in the workplace, the workers will need to return to what they had before, which is mass action, you know, when injustices happen. And, you know, workers have that ability to do that. And we'll go there if we have to.
Mm-hmm. Now, the National Labor Relations Board is not all that strong, is it? I mean, they don't have vast powers here. Arthur?
They don't have vast powers, and they're deeply underfunded. They really don't have the capacity that they deserve to. I just very quickly do want to go back to something that David said in terms of these challenges to the legitimacy of the National Labor Relations Board. You know, in terms of, you know, the political culture and history of this country, I mean, the companies that are challenging the legitimacy of the National Labor Relations Board are Amazon, Starbucks, SpaceX, and Trader Joe's. These are not, corporations that really speak to the rights of individuals. They're some of the biggest corporations on the planet. And so, you know, the importance of workers having the ability to come together and work in concert with one another is really about obviously balancing that, the imbalance of power that is greater now than ever, given kind of the corporate consolidation that we've seen in recent decades. But to today's National Labor Relations Board, I think that part of the reason that we have seen this upwelling of activity and success among new organizing it really lends itself to the National Labor Relations Board being really really supportive of workers' rights and taking an expansive view of what workers deserve and really thinking about the ways in which current U.S. labor law makes it very difficult for workers to successfully organize and win a first contract. And so I think that, you know, the settlement that was handed down from the National Labor Relations Board for the Chipotle workers in Augusta, Maine, when the store was closed was really quite something. I mean, those workers were given substantial financial compensation, and they were given hiring preferences for, you know, stores within the Northern New England region. And that was like that was a very strong signal to the company that if they're going to be doing this, they're not going to be getting away from it. Of course, those companies, including Chipotle, Starbucks, Amazon, for the most part, are companies that do not recognize unions and have not recognized unions. And so this is, you know, these are challenges to their kind of they see these as kind of challenges to the fundamental nature of labor relations within their firms, whereas, you know, there are a lot of other companies where they're used to having a union presence, and so their relationship to workers' efforts to organize is very is often different.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk about the nature of companies and corporate governance in a few minutes, but before we turn the page on that, I want to just ask you both. I mean, one of the big unions in Maine, and because the League of Women Voters, right? We know all about the Maine State Employees Association, because we deal with government people all the time. Are government and public sector unions a little bit of a special case? And I guess that would be true for teachers too.
So the state workers represented by MSEA, SEIU in Maine is a really significant group of workers who've been underpaid for many years, really going back for about 15 years now. There was a study that was conducted coming out of negotiations between the state and those workers that really attempted to look at the wage gap that those workers experienced, comparing workers who serve the state, the public servants of the state of Maine, with similarly placed workers in the private sector in Maine and their public sector counterparts in neighboring states. And that found that there was roughly a 15% wage gap. And so I think that they've been really fighting to bridge that gap. There's really historic job vacancies as a result, I think primarily due to the ways that they're underpaid. And of course, this comes on the heels of a governor who, for two terms, really made it his mission to, you know, destroy public sector workers and a lot of the, you know, public benefits that those workers help administer. And so the Mills administration in recent years has made some improvements. I think that those improvements have just barely kept up with inflation, if they have at all. And so I think that it's very clear that, you know, my colleague James Mile did an analysis and found that there certainly is a persistent wage gap that exists and that really needs to be addressed, particularly in this time when we have quite significant public revenues to do so.
David, I'll ask you this, and I think I read someplace a long time ago that FDR really thought public sector unions were going to be a problem, right? And was not in favor of government workers unionizing. Why did he think that? And why are public sector unions a little bit of a special case?
Most public sector workers didn't gain the rights to unionize until the 1950s, 60s, and then into the 70s, whereas most private sector workers gained the right to unionize in the 1930s, legal rights. And there is, you know, something different about having government as your employer as opposed to a private sector. And so I think, you know, to me, Franklin Roosevelt, it was just sort of such an unfamiliarity with the sort of idea. But when I think about it, yeah, while there are differences between a private sector and a government employer, the fundamental right to come together and be able to negotiate on a relatively even footing should hold true no matter who your employer was. And because the idea that a government employer couldn't be a bad employer, couldn't have bad working conditions is just, you know, really a mistaken view. And in fact, some of the origin stories of the public sector unionization movement, you know, the really close link with Martin Luther King, he went to Memphis where he was assassinated because public sector workers there, black sanitation workers, were being mistreated, called boy again and again, and, you know, were actually crushed to death in the back of their sanitation vehicles because there were not appropriate safety measures taken. And, you know, that the fact that that was a public or a private employer shouldn't matter. The workers should be able to come together and take steps to address that. So to me, that's ultimately, yeah. And the reasons you generally see higher public sector union membership than in the private sector are typically because of a couple of things. The public sector employers can't just leave state, set up shop in Mexico. Also, they typically aren't as anti-union. They don't typically engage in the typical union busing that many private sector employers engage in. That said, they're not always pro. There are plenty of hostile acts, but just it tends to be a little bit more minimized. So ultimately, my view is every worker, no matter who their employer, should be able to come together and negotiate over wages, conditions, and working conditions.
Mm-hmm. You're tuned to the Democracy Forum on WERU-FM. This is Ann Luther from the League of Women Voters of Maine. Our guests this afternoon are David Madland, Senior Fellow and Senior Advisor to the American Worker Project at the Center for American Progress, Arthur Phillips, Economic Policy Analyst at the Maine Center for Economic Policy, and Cynthia Finney, President of the Maine AFL-CIO. We're talking about unions and democracy. This program was pre-recorded on March 13th. No listener calls are being taken right now. I want to just turn now in the closing quarter here to talk about corporate governance and different kinds of corporate structures and whether some of these alternative corporate structures are more union friendly or whether they should be. You know, there's a lot of buzz about ESG, and that is ecology, social corporate governance, I think I've got that right, and CSR, which is corporate social responsibility. I mean, what are these? And do they make employers more friendly to unions or to their workers? Or David?
Sure. So some like the ESG tends to be some sort of outside force trying to, whether it's a group of investors or sometimes even potentially governments, get a look into how a corporation is run. Is it living up to certain values? Is it trying to minimize climate emissions, for example, or is it maybe treating its workers okay? And the corporate social responsibility tends to be like the corporations on their own saying, we are doing X, Y, and Z, and that makes us good. Some of this is real, and some of this is, you know, less real and much more about public relations. I don't think it is a substitute in any shape or form for workers being able to form a union and bargain collectively. To me, actually, that would be an ultimate true measure of whether these labels and number letters actually had meaning, is whether workers really had a more equal footing with them. My bottom line is that these efforts can be useful and have some positive impact, but on sadly some occasions they are not particularly meaningful. And one last thing I just want to add that sort of relates to our last conversation about, you know, many companies choosing to bus unions right now and even going to the Supreme Court to challenge whether the National Labor Relations Act is constitutional. There are some companies that are taking a very different path, not just around ESG, but are choosing to be, for example, neutral with unions. They're not going to fight a union. If workers want it, we're totally fine. And even really big companies like Microsoft choosing to go this path. So there's an option for companies that big profitable companies can exist with unions, and they can choose and see their own business interest in going this way. And my view is it'd be better if more companies went that direction.
Do you find that in your practice, Cynthia, that some employers are, if not pro-union, at least agnostic?
There's an array of attitude toward unions on the part of employers. And sometimes it's surprising which ones have which attitude. Often companies that espouse progressive and or liberal viewpoints and politics. Well, Starbucks is a perfect example of a very large one. But it's also been true among some of the smaller nonprofits in the state, some of whom have been pretty hostile toward their workers trying to form a union, and others of which, you know, the Bangor Daily News voluntarily recognized the union, as did ultimately, it took a while, but the university ultimately voluntarily recognized the grad workers. We'll see what the relationship's like as contract negotiations progress, but it really does vary.
What do you see, Arthur, in your work in Maine, about the difference in employer attitudes towards unions and what the way corporate governance or corporate structures, whether family owned, privately owned, shareholder owned, does that have an effect?
Yeah, I think it's hard to say to kind of look at any set of data for Maine specifically that would suggest one way or the other. But as Cynthia said, it is promising to see some employers in Maine choose to voluntarily recognize their workers' desire to form a union rather than to fight them and to go through a really contentious election cycle. And so we've, you know, here in Portland, Maine, there have been a couple small hospitality shops, coffee shop called Smalls, a restaurant called Kong Tu Bat, both of which recognized voluntarily their workers as well as Coffee by Design. So I really applaud those employers for taking that route. And I think that there is some recognition that, you know, if workers come forward with a really strong demonstration of support for the union, it's in everyone's interests not to have a really contentious election fight. And I think that really also points to the issues with federal labor law, which I think is kind of looming over this conversation, but which we haven't talked all that much about, which is that, you know, the ability of workers to really, you know, effectively form and actualize a union is very different from what you might think based on kind of looking at the letter of the law. And so we see that in a really significant number of organizing drives, union activists or organizers in those shops are fired because the costs of doing so are basically minimal. You just, an employer, when they're found to have violated that law, basically just have to reinstate that worker and pay them back pay, which for the most part is a really small price to pay if you're trying to put down an organizing drive. There's very little pressure on employers to actually come to a contract agreement. So, you know, the majority of newly formed unions do not get ratify a new contract within even 1 year of being recognized. So there are a lot of policy issues at both the federal and the state level that I think can get at these issues. And one of those things at the state level right now is just to ensure that all public sector workers uniformly across the board, when they've come forward and demonstrated that a majority of workers want to form a union, that public body would then have to bargain with them and recognize the union and endeavor to bargain with them so that all public sector workers can operate on the same level playing field. Would love to see that in the private sector as well, but that's a bill that's before the legislature this session.
Companies or corporate management plays hardball and really tries to quash these unions through firing or closing shops or whatever it is. I mean, are there successful strategies in the unionizing playbook that helps unions get by those hurdles? Because it's a long process and takes a little persistence, it sounds like. I see you smiling, Cynthia. Go ahead.
Yeah, under the various acts that govern unions in different types of workplaces, there are processes. So there's sort of a legal path that workers take. And then there's the path of collective action, which is the other way that workers apply pressure. And it seems to me like the most effective strategies that I see are either the collective action or a combination of the legal with collective action, but engaging the members in the fight for what they're trying to accomplish in the workplace is the best way to get there. And lots of unions are doing that.
Can I jump in on just, I just want to sort of add on to Cynthia's comment that there are successful strategies and that they tend to involve, you know, the workers really taking direct action. But I think the difficulty that the workers face is really the bigger point that we want to highlight here, that our fundamental labor law is broken. It makes it almost impossible for workers to form a union and collectively bargain. Just a couple of stats that I think are worth keeping in mind. Private sector union membership today is 6%, which is lower than before the National Labor Relations Act was passed, giving workers the right to form unions, suggesting that the law does very little to help workers form unions, so that there are so many tools that employers have that we need to change the rules to actually give workers a fair shake. And as much and as creative and as important as all these grassroots activities are, they're not enough, because as we started the program, this is a moment for workers and unions right now. The 70% of the public supports unions. Half of the public would like to join a union, and yet 6% of workers in the private sector are members in large part because the law makes it really hard for them to do so.
At this point, I think we're going to sum up, give each a minute to give us your parting thoughts and talk about hopeful signs for democracy, if that comes to you, Cynthia.
Hopeful signs are the amount of activity that we do see. And, you know, there is legislation at the national level to address what David was just speaking about, the PRO Act to strengthen the National Labor Relations Act and make it actually work for all those vast majority of folks who want to be in unions. That's important work to support that. And I think it's also important to think really big as we watch corporate heads with vast quantities of wealth at their disposal, challenging the landscape that gives workers any rights at all to do anything but fight. So it's a question of, you know, do we want order or not? So I appreciate the opportunity to talk about these things today and hope that workers who are listening to this will talk about these ideas in their workplace. That's one of the most important things for democracy, is the discussion of ideas amongst each other and then acting on those ideas.
Thanks very much, Cynthia. Go ahead, Arthur, you go next.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's lots of, as we've talked about, unions are democratic institutions. They help build democratic muscles among their members. People don't choose where they work, and they come together and they find ways to build solidarity across difference. And I think that chips away at some of the polarization that we've noticed really, really creeping up in recent years. They also, just to expand the definition of democracy, they really represents our best opportunity for economic democracy in this country, so that, you know, workers are not just alone in trying to improve the working conditions that they see at jobs, which are often determined by some of the biggest companies in the world. They can come together, and if they stick together, they can really have an impact on what the conditions of work look like. And I would just say that it's very early, but Starbucks Workers United did apparently signal a tremendous breakthrough where there might be a path towards a framework for a contract for the 400 or so stores, including one in Biddeford and one in Portland that was shut down, to have a contract and to have a path for organizing for other Starbucks workers across the country who want to join the union. And that really speaks to their persistence and the solidarity that they experience from students and other unions and workers across the economy. So I think that's a really great sign.
Thanks, Arthur. Go ahead, David, the last word to you.
Thanks. I want to piggyback on what Cynthia and Arthur said about this moment. You know, unions do so much that is good for making democracy function, getting people involved in the process, teaching them how it works. And this is a moment where that is needed more than ever. This is in some ways a scary moment for the future of democracy, where we have, you know, potential threats from authoritarianism coming to us. Yet this is also a similar moment where unions really shone, and where the public came together and said, we need unions now more than ever. And that's in some ways the essence of making democracy work, is the public demonstrating and saying, here is what we want and need and the path forward. And unions are very much a part of that.
That's our show for today. Thank you to our guests this afternoon, David Madlin, Senior Fellow and Senior Advisor to the American Worker Project at the Center for American Progress, Arthur Phillips, Economic Policy Analyst at the Maine Center for Economic Policy, and Cynthia Finney, President of the Maine AFL-CIO. You've been listening to the Democracy Forum, a project of the League of Women Voters Down East, produced in cooperation with WERU-FM. If you have a comment about this show, send it to news@weru.org. Please put Democracy Forum in the subject line. The League's website is lwvme.org for more information about this topic or to learn about other shows in the series. You can subscribe to our podcast at lwvme.org. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next month.